This is Space Kate reporting from the Space Studies Programme 2012, and with me now is Bob Seek, a retired NASA launch director. And you've had quite a varied career. You've worked on some of the most iconic human space flight programs.
Well, yeah, I was fortunate to get in on the ground floor of the human space flight business here, and to the Gemini and Apollo and the shuttle programs. I had I enjoyed a career of 35 going on 40 years, and now I'm retired, and I can look back at it in hindsight and say I was just privileged to be a member of the team that made the great adventure possible.
So you worked on all of them, from Mercury through to Shuttle. That's incredible.
Well, it was at the time it didn't seem like such a big deal. I knew it was all of us that were a member of the team that put the astronauts and the payloads into space. We knew it was special work. It was fun work. We didn't consider it just a job when we came to work at the Space Center and prepared the spacecraft and the vehicles and the payloads. We were on a mission. We didn't just punch a clock and do our thing and consider it a job, but we didn't think it was a big deal. We were proud of what we did, but at the time, this is what we did. Now you look back at it in hindsight, it was a big deal.
I mean, all the kind of missions that you have worked on have inspired so many people around the world, and you know, so many people have become interested in space, have in fact gone on to be a part of the space program because of the things that you were doing back then. I mean, do you still feel that kind of pride now?
Oh, well, yes. Again, now you look back on it and say, you know, we improved the quality of life for not just local area or our country, but all around the world. And it's just look at the medical, the industry, the technology that has been fostered or forced to fruition because of our nation's space program. And it's intangible things. It's too bad that we couldn't put a little bitty NASA meatball on every product or chemical or component that was in some way enhanced due to what we've done over the years putting people and payloads into space, because people would then realize that this is really an important thing in our society for everybody on the planet, not just us in America.
It's funny you should say that, because literally last week I was having a conversation with somebody about exactly this, and we were thinking, is there some kind of hallmark, some kind of made in space or contributed to by space mark that we could put on products? Because, I mean, he was telling a story about, you know, taxi drivers who say, oh, I don't need space anymore. I've got GPS. Why would I need space? And you're kind of like, oh, it's that link between the technology and where it's come from that people seem to be missing.
And that will never end. That's the point. It'll end if we stop having robust space programs. And I remind kids, I'm fortunate. I'm a grandparent, and I have grandchildren that are sixth, seventh, eighth, in that age, early teen. And I remind them that when my grandparents were their age, this would be in the early 1900s, there weren't any spaceships. There were no rockets. There were no airplanes. There weren't even cars. Those words were not even in the dictionary. And there were certainly no computers, television sets, radios, none of that. But in their lifetime, their generation and their kids invented all those things, developed them, made it possible for their favorite grandson, Bobby, to be a member of the launch team that put a man on the moon. And they used the best computer that was available on the planet, the one between their ears. So I remind my grandchildren that they should program their computer, the one in their head, not the one at the end of their fingertips, with the right stuff, math, science, engineering, technology, physical sciences, and they can invent great things also and be part of hopefully a robust space program. And things like computers that exist today will be outdated in their lifetime because of what they do using the computer in their head.
Now, you gave us a very interesting talk this evening, looking at some of the safety lessons that we can learn from some of the problems that the space program has gone through. Starting with Apollo, I mean, you were actually working on that program.
Yes.
So what was your position at that time?
Well, in the Apollo program, I was the official position title, I think, was project engineer, but it was like a technical test conductor. Whenever we tested the spacecrafts that the astronauts took to the moon or took into orbit, we would go on station in our control room and run all of the propulsion systems and the flight controls and the guidance and the communication. And if something didn't work, and that happened often back then, either the procedures weren't right or the spacecraft wasn't built per print, or it was built per print, but that design didn't work, then the technical test conductor has the responsibility of sorting through the problem, getting the experts together, solving the problem, and getting on with the operation and the test. So it was a very rewarding job. There was never a dull moment, and we did it around the clock, 7 days a week, during all the human spaceflight programs. The Apollo program was most rewarding because it had such visibility and support and interest, not only in our country, but around the world. So you knew you were doing something special every day or every night that you went to work. But it was a work environment where we had infinite resources and support, whatever we needed. Money didn't get in the way. Society was such that they knew we were doing things for the first time, so there was a lot of acceptance for risk in
what we were doing. Kind of time, right?
It was a very unique time. People were supportive. The resources were there. We had lots of resources. The quality of the hardware was excellent, outstanding. Businesses and industry wanted to be part of this great adventure. So it was a fantastic time to be involved in the business. It still had risk, and we had our incidents. We had Apollo 1 on the ground. We had Apollo 13 on orbit. But you look back in hindsight, it was very successful, and it did a lot for quality of life on Earth.
So, I mean, pretty much everybody will be familiar with Apollo 11, first man on the moon. And then the next one that springs to mind is Apollo 13. And it's, you know, there's a great film about what happened during that mission and how they sort of struggled to get the astronauts back safely. Could you just tell us a bit about the kind of behind the scenes stuff that happened and what actually did cause the problem that they had?
Well, the problem occurred in one of the liquid oxygen tanks that provided the gas, oxygen gas, for the crew to breathe and also to run the power supplies, which were called fuel cells back then. And there was a component in there that had been overstressed before the flight, actually. And as a result, when the heaters were on before we flew that mission, they were on for such a long time that the temperature in the tank, when it wasn't filled with oxygen, got so hot it melted the insulation off the wires. So we had bare wires inside of this tank that subsequently was loaded with liquid oxygen and on its way to the moon. And one of the times where power was applied to the fans and the heaters in the tank, the wires had obviously touched due to vibrations during the mission, and it ignited the oxygen gas and exploded.
Bare wires is always a no-no. Generally, if you're in space and you've got liquid oxygen around, it's not a good thing. I mean, it sounds like they were lucky to have got to that point in the mission before the disaster happened.
Oh, absolutely. The particular circuits that caused the problem were energized every hour to 2 hours by the crew manually with a switch, in order to keep the oxygen supply in the tank properly mixed. Fortunately, when they threw the switch during launch count on the launch pad, the wires weren't touching, probably because the vibration hadn't occurred enough. If that If they were then, that would have been an explosion on the launch pad. Fortunately, when they turned them on before they got to that phase of the mission where the two spacecraft were docked together so they would have a lifeboat to come back home, it didn't explode then because they wouldn't have had the ability to control and dock the two together. And if it happened after they got in lunar orbit and separated the two spacecraft, then they would have never had the ability to control and get them back together. Fortunately, luckily, or it happened during this roughly 48-hour period when the two spacecraft were docked together and had the integrity that went with that. That's the only time it could have occurred when they would have had a chance to get back safely.
So a horribly unlucky incident,
but in that mission of the 10 days that the typical Apollo mission took, it happened in that roughly 2-day period when they would have had a chance to get back alive. And thanks to the heroics of the crew and the flight team, that's the way it went.
So you were on the ground working the mission at this point in time. I can't even begin to imagine what everybody around you must have been thinking and how hard you would be working and, dare I say it, panicking slightly?
Well, I don't know. Panic isn't the word, but a lot of concern and worry and thoughts and prayers all around the world were, and everybody wanted to help, of course. Yeah, the goal was get the three astronauts back home safely. Do whatever you can in your ingenuity, bag of trip. Suggestions came in from all over the world. We'll try this, try that, whatever. You know, we're all pulling for you, NASA. We want them to get back alive. It was, and for us that were part of the processing of the mission, it was very intense.
So when you saw them finally back on dry land, well, first in the sea and then on dry land,
we were thankful, grateful, and relieved.
I bet. And once they were back safely, I guess questions would have been asked about how did this happen in the first place. Can you just say something about the kind of process that was gone through and what lessons were taken from that?
Well, it's as typical in an event like this. You have investigation boards look at the root cause of the problem, and it usually turns out there's two major contributors. One is a technical issue, and the other is processes, decision making, communication. There's always a sequence of events and decisions that lead up to something like that happening in a complex system. It's not, most people would associate with the fact, well, they threw the switch and the component failed and therefore you had the explosion. No, in this particular case, the problem started months before with the series of events that occurred with that tank and decisions that went with the process after that. And that's really the lesson learned from that incident and most of the other major incidents that we've experienced in human spaceflight. It's a technical issue, and you've got to do all your technical homework and tests and analysis, and then there's the management and the communication that go with any complex process that has to be as perfect as you can get it. And you've always got to keep in mind that if there's doubt and you can't prove that it's safe, then you've got more work to do before you commit to risk, in this case, humans in a complex spacecraft.
I mean, at the moment, we're living in quite difficult economic times. How much do things like budgets and schedule pressures kind of affect those? I mean, you know, in an ideal world, you would test and test and test, yes, and make sure everything's completely perfect. But unfortunately, it's not quite ideal. So how do you get that balance?
Well, the balance is between available resources and schedule is a challenge for management. That's why managers get paid the high bucks to reach the right balance on where the money can be spent to give you the most bang for the resource invested, and you've got to keep the schedule pressure issue, which it also affects money and resources. You've got to work hard to keep that at arm's length so it doesn't influence good judgment. And that's the responsibility of management. Give the people that do the work, the technicians, the engineers, the astronauts, give them all the tools they need to be successful. And that's what you got to keep in mind first and foremost, particularly in a business that's as complex and as hazardous as putting people and payloads into space.
That all sounds like common sense, but when you're in that position as a manager, and you were mentioning in your talk earlier this idea of launch fever, how do you keep your feet on the ground to ensure that you are making the right decision? Or did you ever have any moments where you thought, oh, I don't know?
Well, if you're in doubt, then you need to spend more time analyzing it, and you need to just say we're not going to go fly today or tonight. Composure is important. You have to have confidence in your advisors, the launch team in this case. And personally, I always felt confident with the launch team membership that executes the procedures to get the rocket and the spacecraft and the astronauts off the ground. They would never let, when I was launch director, they would never let me do anything dumb. The biggest challenge for me and for any launch director is to say no when you sense that there is launch fever, that people are reacting too emotionally to try to get off under the pressure of the clock counting and limited time left and the weather's changing and this sort of, you've got to moderate that. That's your job as launch director. And if you feel that the team needs more time to analyze data, talk about it, and turn it into information before you make a decision, then you have to give them the time to do that, even if it means scrubbing or delaying the launch. And that's always a bummer for not only the astronauts and the program on a bigger picture, but for the launch team. But that's your job as a launch director to do that. You have got to say no when everybody else gets launch fever and wants to go, and that includes the astronauts, and they will be the first to admit that they get launch fever too, and they expect us on the launch team, specifically the launch director, to be the ones to say we got to slow down and analyze this, and if it means we can't go fly now, then we won't fly now.
Well, I applaud and admire greatly your level-headedness, and thank you ever so much for taking a moment to talk to me.
Well, it's a pleasure, and best of success to you and the rest of your colleagues at International Space University. I know you're going to have a memorable event time.